Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the science behind the 6 days of creation when we come back. You know, Charles Lyell is one of the pillars of modern geology. Lyell published his Principles of Geology in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated these ideas. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins has been devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. And in that way, catastrophes like Noah's flood are strictly ruled out. Now, this is all called science. Now, listen to this. The sun is shrinking. Now, that was a Newswire report made the surprising statement that the sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by about 0.1% per century. Scientists have been watching for over 100 years, and the evidence is now conclusive. Every hour, the sun is shrinking by about 5 feet. Now, if the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, then it totals 1% per millennium. If the sun existed only 100,000 years ago, it would have been double its present diameter, and only 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth. Now, as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been consistent since the origin of the sun. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the dinosaurs' extinction? Do you remember? That was 65 million years ago. Now, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on this kind of pseudo-scientific lie. And that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the label or title science. And this is one of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that I conduct here twice a year at the law school in Isabella, Missouri. For more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's the place to start. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about the science behind the 6 days of creation. I contend that it's not enough to bash evolution and bash evolutionists. It's certainly a part and parcel with the scientific method or principle to take apart your opponent's thesis, hypothesis, ideas, and show that they're not scientific. We've done that many times in regards to evolution. But that's only half of the story. If we believe that the Earth was created in 6 days, surely there must be scientific evidence out there that we could point to and prove scientifically that that, in fact, did happen. And that's what we're here to do this week. And to help me do that, because remember, I didn't go to college and I don't have a PhD and I'm not a scientist, we have to go to the people with PhDs and who are scientists. Now, let me clarify this science controversy. It's reported that science and evolution are in harmony and in agreement. Well, there are 100% of scientists out there, and they're divided into two persuasions. When polled, 44% of scientists say that they believe in creation, special creation. They believe that creation is the answer to the question, where did mass and matter come from? 56% of scientists interviewed believe that mass and matter have always existed and that it is evolving slowly, changing over time. They believe in the Big Bang. They believe in the conventional or some variation of the conventional evolutionary theory or hypothesis. Now, that's pretty close to 50-50, 44 and 56. Now, there's another factor that enters into the equation, and that is, if you're working for the University of California at the Lawrence Radiation Laboratory, and you say, I am a creationist and I believe in creation, you will be fired. If you work for the Oak Ridge Atomic Energy Commission in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and your name is Robert Gentry, and you're working on an experiment called polonium, and you discover that polonium proves that creation occurred suddenly, rapidly, in seconds. Just seconds. Not eons, not millions of years or billions of years, but seconds. Not minutes, not hours, seconds. You will be fired. Now, that would lead me to believe that the 56% of the scientists that claim that they believe in evolution, probably many of those boys say they believe in evolution so that they won't get fired. Now, of the 44% who are scientists with PhDs and teach in colleges and universities and so on, those people cannot be employed in the high-paying government jobs like Oak Ridge and Lawrence Radiation Lab because they are politically incorrect. So, the politically incorrect scientists cannot have their work published in the scientific journals because the scientific journals are controlled by the government, the Atomic Energy Commission, and the University of California, and the various and sundry evolutionary philosophical centers of research and science. So I really doubt that of the 56% of scientists that claim they believe in evolution rather than special creation, I really doubt that there's 56%. I think a certain number of them, I won't venture a guess as to how many, I don't have any idea, but a certain percentage of those are making the claim that they believe in evolution so that they can keep their jobs at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and the Lawrence Radiation Lab, and I would imagine many other government-sponsored or academically-sponsored facilities, especially in the fields of physics. So I would venture a guess and say that probably it's 50-50 or probably even weighted in favor of creationists. But it's certainly close to 50-50, even if you take the official numbers at 56 and 46, or 44. That's 56% of scientists say they believe in evolution. 44% say, no, I believe in special creation. Now, of the 44% who claim to believe in special creation, I think that it's logical to assume that they're all telling the truth, or at least most of them are, because they don't have anything to gain. In fact, if they would deny special creation and they would admit to and claim to support evolution, they could get higher paying jobs and they could get tenured professorships and they would be economically better off to claim that they believe in evolution than to believe in special creation. So my common sense says to me, they've got something to gain by claiming to be an evolutionist and a lot to lose by claiming to be a creationist. So the guy that says that he believes in creation has to have a truly and sincerely held belief that he's willing to give up his job and livelihood for. Otherwise, he doesn't make any sense. All right, now, with that out of the way, let's take a look at Gerardus. It's spelled G-E-R-A-R-D-U-S. I hope that that's pronounced right. Gerardus D. Bow. His last name is spelled B-O-U-W. PhD. He wrote an article called Creationist Scenario for the Origin of the Universe and submitted it to the proceedings of the 1992 Twin Cities Creation Conference sponsored by the Twin Cities Creation Science Association, the Genesis Institute, and the Northwestern College, assisted by the Commonwealth Foundation. He says in his introduction, given their limited resources, creationists have made great strides in deriving biological and geological models consistent with the creation account of Genesis. Little has been done, however, in the area of astronomy. There, for example, the greatest contribution, and certainly most controversial, is the work of Barry Setterfield on the decay of the speed of light. In this paper, we shall not be concerned with that particular question, but we shall confine ourselves to examining the astronomy of the first 4 days of creation. Now, the first day. According to the Bible, at the start of the creation, the earth and its atmosphere were created first. The earth was unconsolidated, and it says in the scripture, without form and void, inside of a volume of water called the deep, upon whose face the Spirit of God moved. Now, the use of the word face tells us that the deep had a definite surface or boundary. We are not given any hint as to the size of the deep, but the context of the rest of the Genesis 1 account makes it clear that this volume is immensely larger than the earth. The location of the earth's atmosphere, that is, the heaven of Genesis 1 verse 1, is also unclear. But most, or at least most likely, it was inside the water, which was close to or surrounding and possibly intertwined with the formless earth. The atmosphere would exist inside the deep as a shell of bubbles about 8,000 miles in diameter and about 100 miles thick. If the bubbles would rise away from the unconsolidated earth's gravity, as bubbles are wont to do, they would rise a bit more than 100 miles in the course of the first day. So, during the first day of creation, the earth was formless in the water with the heaven, the atmosphere, existing as a bubble or shell of bubbles surrounding it. Then God said, "Let there be light." Now, it is generally assumed that the statement means the creation of all electromagnetic energy, that is, radiation, radiation of radio waves, microwaves, X-rays, infrared, and ultraviolet radiation, as well as the visible spectrum, which alone is light. Now, that is the plain sense of the scripture. Besides, there are other reasons to believe that only light was created at this time, and we shall discover those in the discussion of the creation of the stars on the fourth day. In any event, according to the Bible, the light is not uniformly distributed throughout the creation. Most of the light is to one side of this formless earth, and that side receives the incident light. There was no source for this light, such as we now see in the sun, but the light came from one side of the earth, and it flowed to the other side. The biblical account of the first day of creation concludes with the statement that the evening and the morning were the first day. This statement denotes two possible situations. To signify the day either the formless earth was rotating within the deep, or the deep was rotating around the formless earth. For either of these events to occur, the earth, formless though it was, had to be fairly slushy and compact. Perhaps it had the consistency of gravelly cement. For if the earth had been too unconsolidated, the turbulence in the waters would have disrupted it, scattering it over the course of the day into a lenticular volume of some 48,000 miles in diameter. To solve that problem, one could postulate that the Earth's substance was encased in ice, but doing so would violate the plain sense of the scripture. The air bubbles, which became the atmosphere, could have acted as a shield to minimize the disruption of the Earth's substance. Now this takes us to the second day. And at the start of the second day of creation, the earth was still formless and void in the deep. But during the second day, God removed the deep from off the surface of the earth, and he did this by creating the firmament, which God called heaven. Now, much has been written on the firmament. Most of it is pure speculation. Some have suggested that the firmament was a metal shell surrounding the universe. Others believe that it was a canopy of water, water vapor, or water ice surrounding the earth. The problem with this latter interpretation is that the sun, the moon, and the stars are placed inside of this firmament on the fourth day, whereas the canopy model requires them to be on the outside. So a discussion of whether or not there ever was a canopy is beyond the scope of this paper. But here, our position is that evidence for a canopy cannot be supported from Genesis chapter 1. So of the above two models for the firmament, the former seems to be most consistent with the scripture. But is it really consistent? If the stars are created inside the shell surrounding the universe, then one could most definitely say that they were inside of the firmament. After all, we say that there is air inside of a balloon, don't we? Well, this isn't any different. The problem arises when we discover that God called the firmament heaven. If the shell model is correct, then the scripture could say words to the effect that God called the interior of the firmament heaven, and yet everyone agrees that the heaven mentioned here relates to outer space as opposed to the atmosphere mentioned in the first verse of Genesis. Can it be that the firmament is the vacuum of space? If so, then why would God imply it to be firm? Firmament. Now, in order to see the firmness of space, we should look very closely at it. The question is ultimately one of whether or not space has a fabric or a substance. Now, we all know that in looking through a microscope, we see smaller and smaller things until eventually we see molecules which consist of atoms. Individual atoms have been seen in microscopes, but beyond that, we must use a mathematical microscope. Through the mathematical microscope, we see that the atom consists of electrons, protons, and neutrons. Now, the neutron is made up of an electron plus a proton plus a neutrino. Other particles have been seen in various particle accelerators. Now, the density in the nucleus of an atom is very dense indeed, amounting to about 2 times 10 to the 14th power. Now, this means that a colleague or a collection of nuclear particles the size of a sugar cube, that's 1 centimeter, would weigh about 200 million tons. Firm, though that is, such cannot be the firmament because the space between nuclei seems to be empty. Indeed, a chunk of the universe, the size of a sugar cube on the average, weighs in at only about 0.0 for 29 zeros plus 1. That's 10 to the 29th power per ounce. That is hardly firm. So we must continue looking further through our mathematical microscope. Now the size of the atom is about 10 to the 13th power. The size of the nucleus is about 1/1000th of that. As we proceed to smaller and smaller scales, nothing interesting seems to be happening until we get to a scale of about 10 to the 33rd power per cubic centimeter. At that size, called the Planck length, fascinating things begin to happen, because it is here that we truly hit the fabric of space. To appreciate just how small a Planck length is, note that it is as much smaller compared to man than a man is to 100 million universes laid side by side. Now let's take a look at the firmament. At a scale of the order of 10 to the 33rd power in centimeters, we find that the warp and woof of heaven comes into focus. The science of physics attempts to derive relationships between the different properties of the objects that are under observation. Such relationships typically involve certain constants, values which are generally assumed not to change over time. The speed of light is one such constant. So is the gravitational constant. Now it turns out that there are relationships among the constants themselves, and those relationships all express themselves at the Planck length. For example, the Planck length itself, denoted as L, relates Planck's constant, a unit of angular momentum or spin energy that we call H, the speed of light, C, and the gravitational constant, G, by way of the equation. And he shows the equation here on the page. By the same token, the constants give us a fundamental unit of mass called the Planck mass, which is shown in this formula. And he shows that formula. The basic unit of time is, and he shows that formula. And finally, the fundamental unit of temperature can be derived using Boltzmann's constant K as this formula. And he shows that formula. And so here are 1, 2, 3, 4 formulas. Now, he goes on to tell us that modern science is not certain as to the meaning of these numbers. But the most popular explanation at the present time is that they signify particles which pop into existence, exist for about 10 to the 44th power second, and then pop out of existence again. These particles, called Planck particles, form the basis, and they form the basis for various cosmological theories such as strings, superstrings, and 10-dimensional space. Now, one of the interesting properties of the Planck particle is that they have the same size as both their de Broglie wavelength as well as the black hole Schwarzschild radius for their mass. For most of this century, it has been known that particles do not move in straight lines. Instead, particles such as protons and electrons move in waves. Those waves, called de Broglie waves, vary inversely with the mass. That is, the lighter the particle, the longer its wavelength. So, an electron is larger than a proton, although the proton is much more massive. This is attested to by the observation that the electron orbits or surrounds the proton when the two are combined in the form of an atom. So, the de Broglie wavelength for a particle of mass m is L. As for the black hole radius, if matter is squeezed into a smaller and smaller volume, eventually its gravitational field is so packed that light cannot escape from it, hence the term black hole, as one cannot see it. So the size to which a mass, M, has to be compacted before becoming a black hole is L. So it seems that we are engulfed in a sea of Planck particles. The particles can be viewed as constituting a pervasive medium which acts like an ideal fluid. The density of this fluid, P, is an astounding 3.6 times 10 to the 93rd power. And to appreciate how dense that is, let us return to our sugar cube model. Do you remember that if the sugar cube was filled with nuclear matter, that then it would weigh 200 million tons? So, let us try to envision such a cube made up of Planck particles. If the sugar cube was made up of Planck particles, the numbers are incomprehensible. For example, the mass of the entire universe is estimated to be about 2 times 10 to the 54th power. Packing everything in the universe into the cube would only give us a density of 2 times 10 to the 54th power, which is far short of the Planck medium of 3.6 times 10 to the 93rd power. You would have to pack 2 times 10 to the 39th power. That's 2 followed by 39 zeros. That's 2 with 39 zero universes into the cube to arrive at the approximate density. If this doesn't qualify for the name of firmament, then what does? Now here are the properties of this thing called the firmament. A medium of such a high density as the firmament has some interesting properties. One would think, for example, that it would be impossible to move in such a medium, just as one could not move if encased in iron. Even if one were made of iron, if you were encased in iron, you could not move. Normally, this is true, but the de Broglie wavelengths of nuclear particles are so long by comparison that the firmament is transparent to them. And this is somewhat related to why light can travel through a dense medium such as glass instead of being stopped cold on impact. So we have our first prediction of the firmament model spoken of in Genesis. Motion through the firmament will be effortless as long as we are not dealing with nuclear particles approaching a mass of M, or more particularly, energies of MC2. The firmament will not allow elementary particles to approach that energy without absorbing them. Now, has this ever been observed? Not yet. And the reason for that is that physics laboratories have not come anywhere near creating particles that massive. Should they ever succeed, however, we can expect the particle to disappear in T seconds. And incidentally, the temperature of the firmament is T, far hotter than anything known in the universe. Now, this question arises as to whether or not the firmament is stable. In particular, such stability is called mechanical equilibrium. A body is in mechanical equilibrium when its energy is evenly distributed between the rotational and gravitational energies. Ozernoy, too, has shown that for a body in mechanical equilibrium, the angular momentum density, J, should be related to the gravitational constant, G, and the mean density, P, and the mass, M, as. And he shows the equation below it. Now, where K is the relative gyration radius and KG is a constant related to the mass distribution, for an ideal fluid, such as is the case for the firmament, the exponent of 2/3 on the mass is exact, and the above equation can then be solved for the angular velocity x, yielding this mathematical formula. Where R is the radius of the body, assuming the body to be spherical, this formula becomes, and he shows that formula. Note that this angular velocity speed of rotation for an ideal spherical body is independent of the size of the body being purely a function of its mean density. Substituting in the density of the firmament yields an angular velocity of 5.3 times 10 to the 78th power per second. And normally, one would expect this to be the rotational speed. But since the radius of the firmament does not appear in the expression for the angular velocity, it could also be interpreted as a simple frequency, such as a resonance frequency, or else as the angular velocity of each Planck particle. Did you get that, boys and girls? Well, I hope you did. Now stand by. There's more to come. As we look at the science behind the 6 days of creation in Genesis 1, right after this. Now, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Gordon Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at area code 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember the website georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the science behind the 6 days of creation in an article written by Gerardus D. Bow, Ph.D., that's spelled G-E-R-A-R-D-U-S, D, Bow, B-O-U-W. This was presented in the proceedings of the 1992 Twin Cities Creation Conference, sponsored by the Twin Cities Creation Science Association, the Genesis Institute, and the Northwestern College, assisted by the Commonwealth Foundation. Now let's add a universe of elements to this firmament. Starting with the firmament, let us now add a tiny amount of matter. Let's say one universe. Equation 6 now has to reflect the added amount. Basically, if we let R be the density of the firmament, and R the density of the universe, and if we let M be the mass of the firmament and M the mass of the universe, and if we assume that the firmament and the universe are the same size, then equation 6 becomes, and he cites the equation. So it can be shown that the contribution of the mass factor overwhelms the density factor by 10 to the 40th power to 1. So we need only consider the mass factor, that is, equation 8, is thus simplified to, and he shows that equation. This expression can then undergo binomial expansion, Taylor series, yielding for its first three terms, and here's that equation. Doing this gets us back to our original W, 5.3 times 10 to the 78th power per second for the first term. Now, substituting in the radius of the universe as 1.9 times 10 to the 28th power per cubic meter, a mass of 2 times 10 to the 54th power gives us another smaller angular velocity of about 3.6 times 10 to the 5th power radians second for the second term. The third term is of the order of 10 to the 171st power, so it and subsequent terms can be ignored since the radius of the universe and firmament do not cancel out in this case. That angular velocity must be interpreted as a rotation. Thus, the firmament, with the material universe embedded inside of it, rotates with an angular velocity of 3.6 times 10 to the 5th power radians per second, and this is surprisingly close to a rotational period of one day, which has an angular velocity of 7.272251 × 10⁵ radians per second. Now I'm going to pause right there, boys and girls, and make this observation. I'm not a mathematician. So I would like some of you mathematicians out there, and this is what I have to do, because after all, if I'm not a mathematician, we have to go to the principle of at the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. So, when I have a mathematical problem and I can't solve it, I hand it over to my boy Dirk, who is a mathematician, and I say, would you look at this, read this article, look at these equations, and see if this guy's pulling my leg. I mean, this guy could write any systems, these formulas that are written here, I've got to concede. You know, here's one here, let me give it to you. It says W with a apostrophe equals 2, and then it's got parentheses M plus M, and then it's got 2/3, and then it's got another parenthesis, P plus P, and then it's got 1/6 R-2, and that's called a formula. What the hell does that mean to me? You know, I'm a general contractor. I'm a plumber. That doesn't mean anything to me. Now, I'm sure that if you're a physicist and you have pipes to fix, you might call me the plumber and I'd come out there and fix your pipes. So I do the same thing. I go to a mathematician. Now, if you doubt this final conclusion, remember, we're talking about the 6 days of creation, the six literal days of creation. Are they 24-hour days? Now, this guy has done the math on it. He comes to the conclusion that these days, now let me read this to you again. He says, thus, the firmament, remember we're talking about God separated the heavens and the earth, and he made the firmament, and he made the planet earth, and he said, now, he did this in one day. He did this in one evening and one morning, one 24-hour day. And this mathematician here, he comes to the conclusion, thus, the firmament with the material universe embedded inside of it rotates with an angular velocity of about 3.6 times 10 to the fifth power radians per second. And this is surprisingly close to a rotational period of one day, which has an angular velocity of 7.272251 times 10 to the fifth power radians per second. Now, God in Genesis 1 did not give us all of these angular momentums and mathematical formula. He said plainly, on the first day I created the heavens and the earth. On the second day, I did thus and such, and the evening and the morning were the first day, and the evening and the morning were the second day. That's written for us plumbers, carpenters, electricians, and other blue-collar tradespeople that cannot figure the math. Now, I want to tell you something else here, boys and girls. You can best well bet that the other scientists, the non-creation, that is, the evolutionary scientists, that work at the Lawrence Radiation Lab and work at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, can do this math just like this mathematician did and come to the same conclusion. And that's why I said that I think that the scientists that claim that they believe in evolution say that because they want to keep their jobs. And that's the way it worked in Russia. In Russia, you had to say, if you wanted to be politically correct, and if you wanted to be a working member of the political establishment, you wanted to work in the nuclear program of the Soviet Union, you have to say, I believe in evolution. I don't believe in God. I believe in communism, and I'm a good member of the Communist Party. When you lived in Nazi Germany, you had to be a good Nazi. You want a good job in the party, you want a good job in the society, you got to be a Nazi. In America, you got to be a Republican or a Democrat. You got a choice here. In Russia, you're a communist. In Germany, you're a Nazi. In the United States, you're a Republican or a Democrat. In Britain, you're the same. You got to either be a Labour or a Conservative, a Tory or a Whig. So, the bottom line is that evolutionary philosophy is a religion which is predicated upon being able to hold a job and be politically correct. It doesn't have anything to do with science. Every scientist can do the same math that this scientist did. There's nothing about the arithmetic here. Unless, of course, this guy's a liar and his arithmetic is false, which is why I'm inviting you. Why don't you write in and say, hey, Gordon, photocopy that for me and send it to me. Let me review it and let me see if his math is correct. Now, you can also do this. I'm sure that you can get the proceedings of the 1992 Twin Cities Creation Conference sponsored by the Twin Cities Creation Science Association by getting on the web, doing a Google search, and looking for Twin Cities Creation Science Association or the Genesis Institute or the Northwestern College or the Commonwealth Foundation. Now, I happen to get a copy of this text from Carl Baugh, who is the director of the Creation Evidences Museum in Glen Rose, Texas. I went down there and I said, hey, let me see what you got. And he said, here's what we've got. And I bought this and I brought it home and I read it. Now, just to let you know that we do our arithmetic here, I handed this off to my boy Dirk, who in turn handed it off to another student who is an engineer. But, engineers and people that have a little math background, they can look at these formulas and then get their Texas Instrument calculator out and do the arithmetic and come back and say, well, this guy's right or he's wrong, or his formula is incorrect, and here's what is correct. And the report that I got back is that this guy's correct. Now, if you've got some reason to believe that he isn't, and oftentimes people do that, sometimes they do it and they're dishonest. I mean, you can get guys that want to obfuscate the issue. And so I come along and say, well, the 6 days of creation are substantiated by this fellow, Mr. Gerardus D. Bowe, Ph.D. Now, you could get some other guy to come along, and we'll call him Joe Sixpack, Ph.D., and he can say, oh, no, I'm an evolutionist, and this guy is full of it, and these are all lies, and these formulas are all wrong. And you see, all of us electricians and carpenters and plumbers, we wouldn't know. And so you have a he said, she said. So what I suggest is that you go out and get some independent observations made by people that are mathematicians. You know, go over to a college math department and say to the professor in there or the math teacher, hey, listen, would you look at these formulas and are these correct? And at the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter will be established, and you'll find two or three guys will say, yeah, this guy's correct. That's the way you do that. Now, going on, he says, although the above analysis shows the firmament to be rotating only once every 2 days, it should be noted that the estimates for the size, mass, and density of the universe, are uncertain. Taking that uncertainty into account, the factor of 2 is actually in the 98th percentile or better. This means that the uncertainty in those values is so great that a one-day period is only 2% away from the computed value of 3.6 times 10 to the fifth power. All right, now let's take us up to the second day. Okay, first day works out. Let's take a look and see if the second day means anything. All right, the firmament which God created on the second day is thus an extremely massive structure. Its properties are manifold, and in a very real sense, it determines the very physics of the universe. It was either superimposed on already created atoms, or else the atoms were created throughout it as it was being formed. Now, in either case, the elements had yet to be consolidated into celestial bodies. That didn't occur until the fourth day. We shall look more into the nature of the creation of the elements on our discussion of the fourth day. The presence of the elements meant that the firmament had to rotate in order to keep from disruption. In keeping with the biblical account, the rotation period is 1 day, in perfect agreement with the physics. Now, with the water thus removed, and they could be removed quickly, for speeds within the firmament can be as high as 10 to the 107th power per cubic meter per second. The light now was suspended in the firmament, which carried it about the earth once per day. The firmament itself dictated the frame of reference for the light and all of the particles in the universe. The speed of light was thus, and still is, defined with respect to the firmament. The third day. On the third day of the creation, according to Genesis chapter 1, the waters and the earth below the firmament were separated. This is the time when the earth received its form. The simple reading of the scripture says that the land mass was all in one place. Evolutionists call this place Pangaea. And it is apparent that the Bible records the splitting of Pangaea during the days of Peleg, 200 years after the flood. It is possible that flood waters turned to superheated steam by the extreme pressure in the earth could have caused the continents to slide apart, but such speculation is beyond the scope of this paper. Grass and other plants were formed on the third day. Significantly, this was before the creation of the sun. That is a knotty problem for theistic evolutionists. who would have to conclude that hundreds of millions of years, if not billions of years, plus of evolution would have to occur in total darkness at temperatures of hundreds of degrees below zero. Again, detailed discussion of this subject is beyond the scope of this paper also. Which now takes us to the fourth day. Now, the events of the fourth day of creation are recorded in Genesis 1, verses 14 through 19 in these words. And God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And he made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth, and to rule over the day and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the fourth day. Now, to begin with, we need to emphasize 3 points. First, the lights are in the firmament, not above it. Second, there was no clear division between day and night before this time. And third, the lights in the firmament are generally acknowledged to be the sun, moon, stars, and planets. Historically, there has been a tendency to read more into the word great than is there. Namely, some insist that the word must mean that the sun and moon are the brightest lights in the universe, calling the sun and the moon great. In verse 16, it does not necessarily mean that these are intrinsically the brightest objects in the universe. Instead, the word great refers to their respective roles, the purpose for which each was created. We are told that the sun and moon were created for signs and for seasons, as well as to give light upon the earth. If the brightness of the sun and moon is to be included in the word great, then it can mean no more than the amount of light that each gives to the earth. Now, as for signs, we find that throughout the Bible, the sun is a type of Christ and moon is the type of the believer. That the moon shines by reflected light is consistent with the typology. That the believer shines by reflecting the glory of Christ, hence the term great when applied to these bodies. Now, there are several possible scenarios for the fourth day, each of which is consistent with Scripture. Here I will present the one that I deem most likely. Given the aforementioned stability of the firmament, it seems most probable that the firmament was created with all of the material needed to make the universe inside of it. For reasons which will become evident shortly, we shall assume that the matter in the universe is initially all hydrogen except for the earth and its heaven. The hydrogen need not have been uniformly distributed throughout the universe. It may have been clumped into amorphous blobs. Now, suppose that when God made the sun, moon, and stars, he formed them from the inside out, and that he fused the hydrogen into the heavier elements as he went along. Generally, such a reaction creates a tremendous amount of heat, high-energy neutrinos and gamma rays. However, if that heat were distributed evenly throughout space, if it were thermalized, then the resulting temperature of the universe is about 3 degrees Kelvin, a value which matches the observed and measurable temperature in the universe, which is 3 degrees Kelvin. And it is for this reason that we assume in situ formation of the elements. So when it comes to the planets, it is anyone's guess as to how long it took to cool them during the creation week. Some last-minute formation of neutrons from the fusion of electrons and protons could rapidly have cooled the planets, assuming that most of the radiant heat went out into space, which is not at all an unreasonable assumption if the formation occurred from the inside out. Such rapid cooling would have frozen any boiling features at the planet's surface. In effect, this means that craters could be the last gasp of a boiling surface just before it was blast frozen by the final neutron fusion. That would explain why the Moon and Mars are pot-marked. Now, that fusion would involve roughly 1% of the energy released by the creation of the planet. The boiling may have been so rapid that large drops splattered away from the surface of the planet, solidified on the way, and most would have fallen back to the surface, causing impact craters. There are additional factors which may have entered into the formation of the Sun, Moon, and planets. A different value for the speed of light would have facilitated the reaction rates as well as the final thermalization of the heat released by the fusion of the elements. It is common knowledge among cosmologists that the speed of light is tied to the expansion rate of the universe, and a rapid expansion in the creation week would have resulted in a high value for the speed of light. In particular, as was first noted by Barry Setterfield, expansion of the universe to its present size within the first week would not only age the stars, but also the rocks of the Earth. So in summary, in this paper, we have looked at a creationist scenario for the first 4 days of creation because of constraints on both space and time. The presentation is necessarily sketchy, especially for the fourth day. We find that the firmament, commonly called the Planck medium, is a real, solid object which, to the material universe, appears to have all of the properties of a plenum. And we have noted some of the physical characteristics of the firmament, and others have been presented in greater detail elsewhere. One very significant result of the existence of the firmament, insofar as the Bible is concerned, is that for it to coexist with the material universe embedded in it, it must rotate as a solid body with a period on the order of 1 day. And the scenario presented for the formation of the Sun, Moon, and planets assumes that these bodies were created from the inside out, and that the elements comprising them were fused in place, and that the formation times of the order of a day were short enough to allow the fusion heat to escape into space, where by some mechanism, possibly a much higher speed of light or increased neutrino interactions in an expanding shell just above the formation level, the radiation was thermalized to produce the observed temperature of the universe, which today is at 3 degrees Kelvin. The mechanism accounts for the presence of craters, both impact and non-impact, and predicts that craters should be present on all astronomical bodies whose surfaces could sustain them for 6,000 years or more. Even small ones which should not have survived a crater-forming impact, and it also predicts that non-impact craters will be found to be much more prevalent on the Moon and other cratered bodies than is heretofore believed. All in all, we find that the biblical account of the creation week is not only compatible with scientific fact, but it is also subject to scientific modeling principles. Now, how do you like that? The creation week of 6 days is scientific, and it's scientifically demonstrable. You have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. Remember, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station with more on the science behind the 6 days of creation. Until then, good night, friends.